Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Healing of America. Written and read by Marianne Williamson.
Tough minds, tender hearts. According to ancient Chinese philosophy, the forces of yin and yang are like night to day and darkness to light, feminine to masculine, inner to outer, and heart to head. They balance and border and complete each other, forming together a unified whole. To understand this dynamic is to be more fully aware of the rhythms that underlie all things. Our ultimate ground of being, what the Chinese call the Tao, is the mystical oneness out of which all worldly manifestation flows. To see how the greater oneness is in constant process of giving birth to two, that yin and yang might then come together again and give birth to another one, is to hold the key to greater understanding of anything in the world. Anywhere there's great duality, there's yin and yang, the eternal and the temporal, women and men, philosophy and science, vision and politics. To seek their balance in any situation is to seek the healing of the world. For according to Taoist philosophy, when yin and yang are out of balance, there is tension, disharmony, and discord in the universe. This audiobook is about the yin and yang of American history, the great duality of our miraculous beginnings, the ultimate tearing apart of our vision from our politics, and an effort that could now begin in earnest to repair the resulting wounding of our collective soul. In America today, we have critical problems that will not go away without collective dedication and effort. We must apply ourselves to serious problems with a concentration and a sense of purpose that we do not always summon in more normal times. Those who would have us gloss over those problems or deny them do not help us respond. Those who would lead us into cynicism or anger lead us away from healing. We need deep understanding of our collective problems. We need faith, and we need love. There is so much injustice in America today, and such a conspiracy not to discuss it. So much suffering and so much deflection lest we notice. We are told that these problems are secondary, or that it would cost too much to fix them, as though money is what matters most. Greed is considered legitimate now, while brotherly love is not. Millions of us see this as an unacceptable violation of spiritual truth. We must create the restoration of our collective conscience and turn it into political will. The Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the Emancipation Proclamation, the Gettysburg Address, President Kennedy's inaugural address, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from a Birmingham jail, these are like ancient tablets on which are inscribed our fundamental yearnings and highest hopes. At the same time, the Trail of Tears, the Vietnam War, systemic racism and economic injustice, official hypocrisy, violence, and exalted militarism form a dark and seemingly impenetrable force field, acting like a barrier before our hearts, keeping our hands from being able to grasp those tablets to our chest. It is the task of our generation to break through the wall before us, to atone for our errors, and reactivate our commitment to the promulgation of our strengths. It is not just that we need our sacred tablets. Our sacred tablets, to be living truths, need us. We must begin in earnest an archaeological dig into the American psyche that we might retrieve the tablets on which are written the truths that set us free. This is not an easy assignment, for the layers of our denial are thick and encrusted. Billions of dollars are invested in our not seeing our own circumstances clearly. Then, in our blindness, we continue to support the very system that blocks our vision. Never has there been a time in our history when it was more imperative for the average citizen to think for him or herself. Often, President Kennedy said, "We enjoy the comfort of opinion without the discomfort of thought." Everyone in America has opinions today, but too few of us are doing our very best thinking. Yet there is a new prophetic voice in America saying, as do all prophets, that we must repent, which literally means rethink. This new prophetic voice is not a soloist, but a choir. This time, it will not be possible to silence one prophet, or even a few, and thereby stymie a broad-based impulse for decades. This time, a prophetic calling is seizing the hearts of a critical mass. It is a voice of group conscience and a redefinition of citizen activism in American democracy. There is about to rise up in us, if we wish, a new American consciousness and a renewed regard for the authority of the American citizen. That authority has not been taken from us so much as we have given it away. Therein lies America's disease. In reasserting the potential power of the American citizen, America will heal itself. Martin Luther King Jr. spoke often of our need to have tough minds and tender hearts. He himself displayed that combination brilliantly. Many tough thinkers in America today lack heart, while too many tender hearts lack mental and intellectual acumen. Fuzzy thinking is just one step above not thinking at all. We must pool our intellectual and emotional strengths to create an elixir of healing for our national distress. We have the yang, we must reclaim the yin. We have the intelligence, we must retrieve our souls. We will find a way to put the two together, and out of that union will flow such power of personal fortitude that a revolution of good will occur in America, a reassertion of hope and nonviolent authority. There is a wellspring of love and wisdom in each of us, which is itself, as both Gandhi and Dr. King proclaimed, a powerful political force. Our only true enemy is not people or institutions, but fear-laden thoughts that cling to our insides and sap us of our strength. We must make a stand for our better selves. We must recommit to essential truths, both spiritual and political. To some generations, President Franklin D. Roosevelt declared, "Much is given. From some generations, much is expected." This generation has a rendezvous with destiny. Roosevelt's words uttered in 1936 are relevant today, for our generation has a rendezvous with destiny as well. What we're now in the midst of deciding is whether we'll sleep through the date. Our alternative is to choose to awaken. American Renaissance. Within the next 10 years, America will have a renaissance or a catastrophe. Something is going to happen to take us back to who we are. If America were an individual seeking counseling, a good therapist might say, number one, you're not really sober. Number two, you're obsessed with material things and your spiritual life is begging for attention. Number three, you rarely take responsibility for your own problems and project a lot of blame onto other people. Number four, you've neglected your kids. Number five, the size of the elaborate security system around your house shows paranoid tendencies. Number six, you have a lot of amends to make. Number seven, your attraction to generals is neurotic. Whether the patient takes the cue or not remains to be seen. But for a person or for a nation, everything will erupt in time if we do not attend to the inner life. Radical beginnings. The curtain is now set to rise on the drama of the 21st century. We hold in our minds the possible scripts for its beginning scenes. As Thomas Paine proclaimed in speaking about the American Revolution, we have it in our power to begin the world over again. So do we. Like our founders before us, we live in one of those pregnant moments when a fundamental paradigm that has ruled one chapter of history is ready to pass and give way to another. Entire eras dovetail. At such times, the systems of life are more malleable than usual, and committed individuals have more power than they sometimes do to determine the course of history. It is ours to decide where history goes now, and Western civilization has but two directions from which to choose, transformation or disintegration. It behooves us at times such as these to consider deeply the historical examples of those societies that faced similar challenges and found a way to be reborn without first having to die. The American Revolution was a stunning social rebirth. Our founders repudiated systems of feudal authority that had been entrenched in Europe for centuries. The Americans declared all men to be endowed by rights given them not by a king, but by God. Our founders risked their lives to make that historical break from the past, boldly changing the course of human events. They reached beyond the accepted boundaries of what was to be expected from life and stretched the limits of human possibility. They left in their wake a compelling promise, not only to Americans but to people throughout the world, that a society could exist in which the individual talents and abilities of free, self-governed people could come together fruitfully, forming out of what is always potential chaos, something creative and good. The New Enlightenment. The American founders were intellectual citizens of the Age of Enlightenment. At that time, the governing intellectual assumption was that all human knowledge and experience had come together in a great confluence from which human beings could distill general principles of nature and society. The means of this distillation was the exercise of reason. The great intellectual model of the Enlightenment was Isaac Newton, who deduced and articulated the principles of what we have ever since called Newtonian physics. Many American statesmen with intellectual ambition, James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, John Adams among them, aspire to become the Newton of politics and government. Now, at the end of the 20th century, the world has corrected and improved upon Newtonian science. Reality is not quite as solid or objective or deterministic as Newton thought. Heisenberg, Bohr, and Einstein were thinkers as revolutionary in their time as Newton had been in his. While the thinkers of the Enlightenment exalted the faculty of reason, quantum mechanics proved some unreasonable things to be true. For example, time flows at different rates for observers moving at different speeds. Solid atoms are largely empty. Subatomic phenomena are both particles and waves. Particles seem to affect each other at a distance, even in the absence of a known causal connection. And, according to Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, an object is affected by the act of being observed. As British physicist Sir James Jeans proclaimed, the world now turned out to be not quite so much a great machine as a great thought. Quantum physics gives human consciousness a much more central role in the larger scheme of the universe than did Newtonian physics. How we perceive and how we interpret things are more than mere symbolic powers, opening the modern mind to a more spiritual interpretation of reality than has been intellectually in vogue for centuries. As our founders sought to apply the knowledge of Newton and the Age of Enlightenment to the politics of their time, we should try to apply the principles of modern physics and metaphysics to the politics of our time. Creative chaos. We are exiting a material age which has lasted for thousands of years and are entering an ideational age. We are, as a species, shifting our focus from extrinsic to intrinsic value. We are living during dramatic times of historical transition, in which our psyches and our social orders are trying to adjust to the often violent shift from one primary mode of civilization to another. Where the Atlantic meets the Pacific, the waters are turbulent. When one major historical epoch meets another, the psychic and emotional waters are likewise turbulent. Navigating those waters is difficult, but mastering the waves brings an exhilaration that those living in less exciting times will never know. An entirely new Weltanschauung or worldview is on the horizon. The outer world will no longer be looked to as the source of our power or our salvation. The belief that it ever was our salvation was a delusion fostered by the seductive, gross materialism of our technological, industrialized age. Transcendent philosophical traditions reveal that true power is sourced within, is ever renewable through the grace of God, and is activated through human dedication to whole-centered rather than self-centered goals. From alternative health practitioners to corporate trainers teaching creative visualization techniques and spiritual basics as keys to business revitalization, to the internet communications revolution that has already lessened the ability of the communications autocracy to control the flow of information, we Americans are in the process of building for ourselves a society no longer limited by a strict and rationalistic materialism. This effort annoys and angers those who would prefer that we enter the 21st century with no fundamental changes in our approach to being human. But history is not static. New attitudes based on the awareness of spiritual principles have been embraced now by enough Americans to turn the tenets of higher consciousness into a major force for social change. Political as well as social issues will come to bear the mark of this transformation as we continue our countdown to a new millennium. The zeitgeist of the 20th century was very different than its 19th century predecessor, and the zeitgeist of the 21st century promises to be very different still. Our understanding this is vital. Therein lies great potential for the release of massive healing energies here and around the world. political salvation. We are now learning as much about waging peace as we have known for ages about waging war, and as much about the power of love to heal us as we have known about the power of hate to destroy us. The extraordinary technological changes on our horizon are mere adjuncts to the even greater explosion of possibilities within the human mind. It is not only our interconnectedness technologically that promises to shift the world we live in, but even more so, the realization of our interconnectedness humanly and spiritually. It is not new material resources that promise to arise in our midst, but rather resources of soul and creativity that promise to provide us with rich and exciting new frontiers. The contrast between this exciting future and the way we govern ourselves couldn't be starker or sadder. Politics in America has become just another business. It is more authoritarian than democratic, having less to do with us and more to do with them. Politics as we know it now is a materially based process focused through dense, fear-laden consciousness. But politics, like everything else, promises to change radically in the coming days as a broad-based awakening of human awareness causes radical expansion of hope and possibility. Renaissance is a social uprising centered not on our streets but in our minds, an outpicturing of years of accumulated internal shifts within millions of people. Many who have focused their political and social efforts solely on external change have come to see how superficial and temporary such change can ultimately be. Many who have sought personal growth as a path to global transformation have begun to extend their efforts into the outer political realms. The former group are America's social and political activists, while the latter are America's modern version of the spiritual contemplative. It is the balance and intersection of these two impulses, the political and the spiritual, that will foster the rebirth of American democracy and form the crux of a new revolutionary power. This renaissance will come from neither the left nor the right. It is neither a bridge to the past nor a bridge to the future, but a bridge to who we most deeply are. The bridge to a better future is a shift in mass consciousness to a part of ourselves we have tempted to keep out of the public realm. That part of us is not interested in traditional politics. It is who we are when we are hushed in church, near tears when they blow the shofar on Yom Kippur, honest and vulnerable with our therapist. It is the part of us least acknowledged, maintained, or seemingly even valued at all by the social order we have created around us. It is the part of us that still hopes for miracles and at times can even see them. That place in each of us is the key to our personal and political salvation, for it is from that inner sacred place that we genuinely join with others. It is in joining that we turn back our lower natures, allowing the angels room to breathe within us. It is in Americans joining with other Americans that America will be healed. Mind asleep, mind awake. Just as the European Renaissance was a break from the stultifying effects of the domination of the Roman Catholic Church, today's Renaissance is also a rebellion against the stultifying influence. But this influence today is in a way more difficult to overcome, for it is not institutionalized, but systemic. It permeates all our institutions, from education to media, even politics. It is the deadening of the American mind. In early America, people discussed politics in the taverns. The early equivalent of today's longshoreman was as well informed about political issues as was the colonial equivalent of today's business mogul. Democracy means that all of us must become engaged in the big picture of society's affairs. The price you pay for not thinking about something important in your life is that there will always be someone else eager to do your thinking for you. What you don't decide, they'll be happy to decide for you, and obviously, they may not love you. We must reclaim lost ground. We must stand up, millions of us, in full intellectual and emotional glory, and so express our own uniqueness in the service of a greater good that the forces that would constrict us are transformed in a great awakening. In the presence of people whose minds are awake, the great sleep cannot come upon us. Only in this way can we reassume the power of American citizenship. And that power to be noble must be the power of conscience and compassion. That is the only power that comes from God. Looking around the world today, we see tremendous violence, killing, and assertion of brute force. From street gangs in America to chaos in the Balkans, power without conscience is exploding all around us. the next major unfolding in the progress of human liberty will emerge from our expanded capacity to love. We must become as vigilant, focused, and effective at the expression of love's power as others now are in the expression of their hate. We must live for the day and work for the day when human society realigns itself with the radical love of God. In a truly democratic paradigm, there is no love of power for power's sake. Power exists for one good reason and one good reason only: to provide the opportunity to extend the higher processes of life. In the hands of the immature, the purposes of power are narcissistic or authoritarian, used to increase the dominance of one individual or group over another. True democracy demands a very mature use of power, a deep appreciation for its positive value, and an equally serious vigilance against its misuse. Worldly power, financial and political, should not be avoided, but rather used to extend the love of our Creator to every corner of the universe now darkened by its absence. Power should not support the status quo. It should always be cutting through yesterday's complacency to create tomorrow's safety for ourselves and our children. One mind, one heart. There is a scientific theory that the universe is like a hologram. Imagine that you have a photograph of someone, and you tear the picture down the middle. You now have two pictures, one of the person's left side and one of his or her right side. But if you have a hologram, and you break the picture in two, then you are left with two complete images, each slightly less clear than the original, but total nevertheless. So it is that each of us contains within us not just a piece of the whole, but a level of the whole in its entirety. That is why when we change, so does everything on some level, for better or for worse. This makes a conscious person feel more responsible for the world, yet also more hopeful. For what we do and what we are carry more influence than we might previously have imagined. America's Renaissance is a quantum phenomenon whereby we change the society not only through awakening others, but through our own awakening. Our own transformation influences the world, for all minds are joined. We need not stop in fear when we read a newspaper report of something that shouldn't be happening. If enough people read the same article and think the following thought: this should not be happening in America. I am committed to this not happening in America. Then that alone contributes to a new vortex of power, a moral vortex, a motivational momentum, and that becomes political power. Every awakened thought, meditation, and prayer is a vote to turn the world around. We must rethink the world before we can change it. Until then, all progressive action will merely take us in circles. It is internal power which can give us a new footing in the external world. The only way out of outer darkness is through inner light. Gandhi stressed that society cannot be divided into watertight compartments. We are living at a time of whole systems transition, in which the only way to address a piece is if you have a powerful grasp of the whole. Everything affects everything because all things emerge from consciousness. Because of the incredible power of the electronic media, our thoughts are magnified a trillionfold. American pop culture is a context in which someone has a thought and millions join them in that thought within minutes. This is the good news and the bad news also. We have become, through the electronic media, one global brain. Now we must become one heart. The heart of America. If we desire an American Renaissance, we must re-educate and re-empower ourselves. We must seek depth as well as breadth of activity. We must reclaim our capacity to think and feel as powerfully and deeply as possible and expand our capacity to love. What matters now and always is whether God's love infuses the things we do. What is not love is an illusion. It does not matter how sophisticated an illusion or how technologically stunning the application of its power, we must seek to leave illusions behind us. The purpose of our lives is to bring forth on earth as perfect an expression as we are capable of achieving of the goodness of the human spirit, for us to mine that spirit in our children and exalt it in their nurturance, to devote our undertakings to the flowing forth of that spirit in all things and all people, making all else secondary to the achievement of that goal. This is the calling that will renew America, for this is the call to awaken our soul. Democracy means we are free to do whatever we feel in our hearts that we should do. The noble practice of democracy is our willingness to do it. A threat to democracy is anything that would have us believe that something else is more important. Herein lies our renaissance. a nation so conceived. Our founders were acutely aware that generations of Americans would be living under the influence of the principles they set down. As the architects of the American experiment, they eagerly scoured history for the best ideas to draw from republics ancient and modern, to English common law constitutionalism and state constitutions, to the writings of Renaissance and Enlightenment philosophies. No body of knowledge or experience was irrelevant to their quest. They were also religious men, though of a kind that modern fundamentalists might not recognize. They saw no hostility between religion and science. John Adams described God as the great legislator of the universe. Theirs was a reasonable religion, and the total and complete freedom to worship or not and to whom was central to their conception of American liberty. America's first principles are not partisan issues. They are the things on which we have agreed to agree. We agree that power in America shall stem not from the government into the people, but rather from the people into the government. We agree to seek to balance individual rights with protection of the general welfare. And we agree that people shall have the right to freely practice and share their religious, social, and political beliefs without threat of external tyranny. In 1801, our President Jefferson asked all generations of Americans to make periodic recourse to first principles. A nation so conceived, in the words of Abraham Lincoln, is so radical in its inspired authority that there have been times in our history when the critical mass of American sentiment has not measured up to our own first principles. The Civil War, for instance, was a contest pitting those who chose to hold the nation to its principle of equality for all against those who tried to secede from the Union rather than give up slavery and comply. In other words, our governmental principles are often more advanced than we are, owing to the extraordinary prescience and genius of our founders. The fact that Thomas Jefferson, as an owner of slaves, did not fully live up to those ideals does not mean the ideals themselves mean less. It means that Jefferson began a process he did not complete, one that we have still not completed, yet which every generation of Americans must try its best to further. The fundamental ideals of American society are just that, ideals. They are transcendent archetypes that stand over and above the material realities of life. It is not our role to merely complain if our reality doesn't match the ideal. Rather, we should further the process by which the reality will someday, for some generation of Americans, completely reflect the ideal. To do that, we must ourselves embrace the principles. America's first principles are simple and basic. They are undergirded by an even more basic idea, that we are a democracy and thus govern ourselves. These principles are guideposts for the process of doing so. They are the keys to our freedom and the freedom of our children. They are as follows. First, equality of rights and opportunity, that all of us are equal before God and should be treated that way by the American government. Second first principle, e pluribus unum, that within our diversity lies a national unity, that we are at the same time a people who reflect and embody diversity, yet are united by fealty to these treasured first principles. Third first principle, a balance of individual liberty and protection of the common good, that it is the responsibility of government to protect the general welfare, yet with enough checks and balances to ensure that it remains limited enough to guarantee our individual liberties. And finally, fourth first principle, religious freedom, that every American shall worship how he or she wishes, if he or she wishes, according to the individual's own conscience and with no governmental interference in that right. Let's talk about these four principles in more detail. Principle 1, all are equal and shall be treated equally before the law. The wording of the Declaration of Independence is as follows. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. This principle is easy to take for granted until we remember how essentially radical it is. It means that in this country, it is not the circumstances of our birth, but the fact that we are American that determines our rights and opportunities to pursue happiness. Note that the Declaration says that it is the responsibility of government to secure those rights. Regarding both rights and opportunities, equality as a first principle is threatened in America today. But this threat is largely underestimated. It is couched in words that imply we take equality for granted here, that of course we all believe in it, and therefore we need not be vigilant on its behalf. That is a dangerous falsehood. Every time we take support away from nutritional, medical, educational, or job training and creation programs that benefit those who need them most, then give tax cuts to the far more privileged, we are attacking the first principle of equality. Thomas Jefferson said that we must endlessly struggle for and never be complacent until we have achieved equal opportunity for modest prosperity and equal treatment before the law of every American citizen. That is central to the notion of liberty in America. When there is little adequate education, as in the inner cities of America, there is no equality of opportunity. Where there is little adequate health care, as among America's poor, there is no equality of opportunity. Where there are very few opportunities for true professional advancement, as is also true among America's poor, there is no equality of opportunity. Many issues look different when seen through the lens of the first principle of equality: universal health care, education, and criminal justice, to name a few. The political question, for instance, should not be, what do you think of homosexuals? But rather, do we or do we not remain committed to the principle of equality for all? And how does that principle apply to the quest for homosexual rights? Whether someone in America likes someone else in America is irrelevant to what both of their rights should be before the law. Principle 2, unity in diversity. Our founders were wide-ranging thinkers and students. They learned directly or indirectly from every body of ideas and information available to them. Both Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson were careful and respectful students of the government and politics of the Iroquois Confederation and other Native American peoples. In the Iroquois Indian Confederacy, different Native American Indian tribes retained their individuality, yet created a common network for the sake of progress and mutual protection. Echoes of that governmental philosophy, among others, can be found in America's first principle, E Pluribus Unum, or unity in diversity. There are people in America who overemphasize our unity, yet fail to appreciate the importance of our diversity, just as there are those who emphasize our diversity, yet fail to appreciate the importance of our unity. It is imperative that we honor both. Unity and diversity are not adversarial, but rather complementary parts of a unified whole. They are, at their best, synergistic partners in the creation of a more highly evolved culture. We are woven from many diverse threads, yet we make one piece of fabric. We are one and many at the same time. You're a Catholic and you're an American. You're gay and you're an American. You're black and you're an American. It is when we have a healthy experience of our individual identity that we can most easily accept sharing a larger one. But the former step cannot be skipped. It is wrong to expect someone to play down his or her religious or racial or sexual or cultural identity in service to a larger identity until he or she has first been shown honor for what that individual identity is. At that point, once we've all been acknowledged as individually significant, it is important for us to then turn our attention to how we might serve together a greater whole. Unity in diversity is a principle that demands of us personal maturity. We must develop the ability to tolerate the creative chaos of many voices and opinions all expressing themselves at once, to not seek control over the thoughts or behaviors of others just because they are different from us, and to listen with respect and recognize the dignity of those with whom we disagree. This principle, as well as the freedom of religion, demands that we go much further than mere tolerance. There are people in America who tolerate through clenched teeth, who respectfully disagree with a look that is chilling. Liberty depends on our understanding that America belongs to all of us. Equality means that none of us is inherently better than anyone else. Freedom means we actually like it that way. Principle 3. The federal government shall secure the collective welfare, yet with enough checks and balances to ensure individual liberty. This first principle demands our very best thinking and action. Yes, it is true that we must protect the environment and the children, but yes, it is also true that the individual should be as free as possible to pursue personal economic goals without interference or obstruction. Yes, it is true we must protect the rights of the citizen from too much police or government involvement in our own affairs. But yes, it is also true that law enforcement officials must have the means they need to protect us. Very few of us can honestly say that we do not get carried away sometimes overemphasizing either individual rights or collective welfare. What we need at this time is a passion for creating balance between the two. President Eisenhower once said that the American mind at its best is both liberal and conservative. We must seek to conserve those things that are eternally true while retaining the ability to respond liberally and spontaneously to the immediate demands of our time. Principle 4. All Americans shall be free to find God or not find God, however their conscience permits. The separation of church and state was not meant to religiously constrict us, but rather to religiously free us. A thick line between the state and religion allows the religious world to go forward untethered by state interference, and it allows the state to go forward untethered by religious interference. It is an enlightened concept. But separating the state from the undue influence of religious institutions should not be an impediment to the search for higher truth within the political arena. Spiritual understanding is a human need, not just a religious issue. Without it, the world does not make sense, and any human endeavor that leaves it out of consideration will not end up making sense either. The genuine religious impulse is an internal phenomenon, and civilization has always suffered when any particular dogma or doctrine has sought to impose itself upon the peoples of the world. The highest, most spirit-filled religious consciousness is a living water. The container through which that water is poured into the world is not an organization or a religion, but the human heart. Love is the religious experience. No religion has a monopoly on God. Religion itself has no monopoly on God. Ecclesiastical, orthodox religious systems are not the only arbiters of spiritual force. We will not be renewed by a worldly religious authority. We will be renewed by God Himself. We must not indulge any group of Americans who seek to ban other people's conception of spirituality from the public sphere on the basis that it is not of God, when in fact it simply isn't in line with their conception of God. We are not a Christian nation. We are not a Jewish, Muslim, or Hindu nation. We are not a Buddhist, Sufi, Baha'i, or any other officially religious nation. We are not an atheistic nation. We are a nation where religious freedom, including the freedom not to believe, and religious pluralism are sacred first principles. No one is free unless all of us are free. Our founders did not wish to keep God out of the public sphere, but merely to make our society a place where he or she, by the way, could be freely sought or not sought, according to an individual's proclivity. Indeed, religious pluralism is a most crucial issue in the world today. We should be learning more about our own religious traditions and the traditions of our fellow Americans. In this way, we will come to know the unity of our religious diversity, without which we cannot appreciate the full genius of our American system of government or the greater glory of God. Doing our own thinking. Americans are being asked, as we were asked over 200 years ago, to decide for ourselves and our children what it is worth to us to govern ourselves. While it appears that we have problems very different from those faced by earlier generations, it is in fact not the complexity of our current affairs, but the simple drama behind them that Americans most need to consider. What we call the issues are not the issues. The great issue of this particular moment in history is not taxes, balancing the budget, Social Security, or Medicare. Those items are rather elaborate red herrings. The great issue that confronts us, as it confronted Jefferson's generation and Lincoln's generation and every generation to some degree, is this. Is America to be ruled by all of us and for all of us? Or has the American government in fact become a government of, by, and for a relative few? If ours were a government for the people, wouldn't our children receive the best education in the world? If ours were a government for the people, wouldn't we eat the healthiest food and breathe the healthiest air? If ours were a government for the people, wouldn't we have universal health insurance? If ours were a government for the people, wouldn't we have massively committed to clean energy sources by now? A mean group of selfish people did not decide to steal America. What happened is we gave her away. We have failed to be vigilant on behalf of our own good. We have failed to make periodic recourse to first democratic principles, settling for the disempowerment of ignorance and distraction. We have turned our eyes away from things that in a free and democratic society, the average citizen cannot afford to turn his or her eyes away from. We must turn them back. Rebellion as a mature act. A complete cycle of growth always includes rebellion. The teenager who does not rebel in some way, for instance, misses a critical piece of personal development. After rebellion, however, must come a unique contribution. Our founding generation did not just fight a revolutionary war. They wrote and maintained the U.S. Constitution as well. While a teenager must rebel in order to mature, so she then must mature beyond the rebellion and initiate life at a higher level than the one she rebelled against. In a world where selfishness is the accepted ethos, a commitment to social justice is a rebellious mode of being. What is happening in America today is that there's not enough spirit of true rebellion. While a market-obsessed corporate mentality lords over us like a new ruling class, we act more like royalists than like our own revolutionary forebears. This time, we're not being assaulted directly, as the colonists were by the English through endless taxes and other burdens, but rather through an endless dripping stream of pleasure that the system is able to provide us, much like a low-grade morphine pump pushed into our veins, making us think we can't live without it. Pleasure can be used to enslave a person as effectively as pain. And so, while we're not happy, perhaps we're having fun in some peculiar way, or are so addicted to the pure adrenaline rush of contemporary culture that we no longer question the pain of it all. If this continues, we will lose America. America has spunk, but we're also immature. We're often perceived by the rest of the world, and with good reason, as a brilliant, obnoxious teenager. Our challenge is to retain our sense of optimism and vitality, yet drop our mantle of childish inconsideration for anything and anyone but ourselves. Our founders were anything but immature. At the end of the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson wrote, "And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor." I doubt that too many people today have asked themselves what that means. The signers of the Declaration of Independence were, by so signing, committing treason against the King of England. Had they lost the war and been captured, they would have faced the most horrific penalty under English law, hanging, drawing, and quartering, in which your major organs are removed from your body before you're actually dead, then burned in front of your eyes. They did not just declare a war then. They themselves would fight it. Though they were men of genius, they were also men of great personal courage. Who in our generation can easily relate to the signing of a document at the risk of death? Who in our generation can easily relate to such heroic commitment for the sake of one's country? Most of us can't, but many of us would want to. For current generations of adult Americans would like nothing more than to fulfill some sense of historical destiny. We can, and perhaps we will.